This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. It is Election Day. Now, many North Carolinians exercised their right to vote early before today, but even this morning, there were long lines in some places. Voters are deciding who will be their president, their U.S. senator, their governor, their representative in the 13 congressional districts of our state, as well as they'll be deciding the seats on the state Supreme Court and Court of Appeals and the Council of State races. But how much will your vote in North Carolina count today in the presidential race? Experts who've been watching the polls have already put North Carolina's 15 electoral votes in President Bush's column. But if the Electoral College system calculated the votes differently, would North Carolina be more in play? That's one of the questions we consider this hour. You can join our conversation at 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. Has there been something about this presidential and otherwise electoral season that has struck you and you wanted to comment or question that? Our number, 1-877-962-9862. To answer some of our Election Day questions and talk about the most important races today, we welcome back Tim Versalotti, who is political science professor at Elon University and director of the Elon University Poll. Welcome back, Tim.
Hi, Melinda. It's good to be back.
Hey there. Well, one more time on our U.S. Senate race. Richard Burr back in Winston-Salem today. Erskine Bowles, the Democrat, is out there making more campaign appearances. Is this a sign of who's confident of victory and who's pulling out all the stops?
I think it's more a faith in who has the greatest faith that last-minute efforts are going to make a difference. I think both sides acknowledge that it's a tight, tight race, and they seem to differ on whether those last-minute efforts are going to get some folks out to vote. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Are you willing to call that race?
No. I've learned that political scientists are much better at explaining than predicting. I'll be happy to explain it down the road.
But we should say that the latest polls that we had a few from about a week ago when people were polled here in North Carolina, this is the WUNC, WRAL-TV, and the News and Observer poll, it had it with Burr with 47 Burr and Bowles at 46%, so it seems quite neck and neck.
That's right.
Now, early voting has been a huge part of this year's election story. The individual county boards of elections, some of them were reporting upwards of 30% of their registered voters having voted as of this past Saturday. And they can start counting those ballots. I checked with the state elections office. They can start counting those ballots as early as 2 o'clock this afternoon. Conceivably, they could have those figures for us right away when the polls close at 7:30 tonight. Do we have a sense of who's getting those early voter votes?
We have a sense nationally. I haven't seen any studies statewide, but because the big question, and North Carolina is not unique, about 30 states have early voting, and there have been large voter turnouts in quite a few of them. And the question is, did that portend a heavy turnout today, or did it redistribute voters who would have come out today anyway? And the bit of survey data that I have seen suggests that the folks who turned out tended to be more strongly partisan, tended to be older. In other words, the folks who were going to turn out anyway today. So the real question in terms of high turnout will be what are we seeing at the polls today? And we've all heard anecdotal reports, especially from the swing states, of heavy turnout, but we really won't know till the end of the day how heavy the turnout is, obviously.
Mm-hmm. And I guess for someone in your line of work, that you may be happy to know there may be a post-mortem you can do, because those votes are going to be counted as absentee ballots, and then you can parse them out later on.
Absolutely, sure.
To see how they did. What legislative races are worth watching here in North Carolina?
You mean in terms of the House of Representatives? Most of the districts are pretty safe seats. There are a couple that bear watching. The 13th district is Brad Miller's district. It extends from Raleigh north along the border counties and then back south into Burlington and then back south again into Greensboro. And he's had a feisty opponent in Virginia Johnson, a congressional staffer who lives in Greensboro. And One would argue Brad Miller, when he was in the state Senate, oversaw redistricting and drew a fairly safe district here. But this is his first reelection bid, and that's a real test of strength for folks coming off their first term in the House of Representatives. If he's going to have trouble, it would be with this one. So it'll be interesting to watch to see whether the district that he drew is going to hold up for him as he seeks a second term. The other one that's been much closer than anyone had expected was Charles Taylor and Patsy McKeever in the western end of the state. Folks had assumed Taylor had a fairly safe reelection bid, and polls from the Republican Party, and Taylor is a Republican, showed him fairly far ahead, but some of the Democrat polls have McKeever within 1 or 2 points, so that's another race to watch tonight.
And, you know, on the subject of some last-minute campaigning, yesterday there were some newspaper subscribers of the Raleigh News and Observer who received their newspaper inside of a plastic wrapper that had Richard Burr, the Senate candidate's face, on the outside, along with words that said it was in, you know, this was being paid for by the National Rifle Association, the NRA. The publisher of the NNO told us yesterday that this was a paid ad. Of course, unlike the ads inside the paper, which appear on paper, this was on the plastic that was wrapping the newspaper. Are you surprised to hear about that kind of, you know, last minute bid there?
I was a bit surprised. I saw that item in the paper today as well. And I think people are accustomed to seeing those ads. You see department stores or sometimes new products are advertised on those wrappers and you don't think anything of it. It's unusual, though, to see a candidate out there. I wonder how many folks really did interpret it. There was some concern that someone interpreted it as a newspaper endorsement. No one puts their endorsements on plastic wrappers that usually end up soaked in rain, covered in leaves, and then tossed in the trash. But it's the another boundary falls in terms of campaign advertising.
Mm-hmm. I suppose we could do a show dedicated to people calling in and giving their suggestions of where ads may appear the next time we have an election.
Well, I wouldn't encourage them.
Well, Tim Versalotti, you know, North Carolina has not really been in play for the presidential race. There had been murmurings, even some poll figures out this summer when North Carolina Senator John Edwards joined the Democratic ticket, that John Kerry was getting a bump in the polls and that North Carolina could go to Kerry. John Edwards this morning on one of the talk shows was thinking North Carolina might be in play, but the polls are indicating it has not been. And indeed, we haven't really seen the candidates coming here to campaign as they have Ohio and Wisconsin, those swing states that could go either way. And all of this is because of the way we have the Electoral College set up. So would North Carolina, in your view, be better served if we had a different system in place? Something other than the Electoral College, the all or nothing at all game of awarding those votes?
We had a brief taste of that in mid to late July, right after Edwards joined the Kerry ticket. Both campaigns did start buying some TV time, and we did see Kerry and Edwards in North Carolina. And so for a brief moment, we felt like our vote truly did matter, and I think that got people fired up on both sides, both Republicans and Democrats. And then that quickly petered out, and I don't think anyone really expects the state to be in play tonight. Any time your state gets visits from candidates, you see some advertising, you get more information, I think that's good for the voters. It's harder on the campaigns. They've got to spend some more money. But from the standpoint of democracy, sure, I think that would be terrific if more states were in play. Now, we could call people in Ohio and Wisconsin today who would say, you can have it, because they've been absolutely bombarded with automated phone calls and advertising and knocks on the door. But for those of us sitting on the outside looking in, that seems pretty attractive right now.
Okay, let's go to Julie in Durham, who has a comment along these lines. Hi there, Julie.
Hi. It's interesting the direction you're going in right now, because I noticed, I'm originally from Maine, and I noticed that they got some attention from national candidates this year, which is something that in my lifetime I've never heard of happening. And when I heard comment being made about it, it was because of the way they split their electoral vote.
In other words, it's not all or nothing at all. It's split proportionally.
Exactly. Well, I think it's just a 3-1 split, so I'm not even sure if it's proportional. But in the comment that your guest just made regarding that, you know, all these, some the swing states, the battleground states get all the attention and the rest of us are kind of shut out from that. I know I drove through Pennsylvania recently and I was amazed. And I realized they're spending a lot of money in those big states. And it makes me wonder if we all, if all 50 states had some sort of electoral college split, wouldn't that mean that they would have to spend their money around a little bit more, that that every state would end up being a bit of a battleground, and yet they really wouldn't be in a position, I think, to deluge the entire country, at least not until the campaign budgets got even more astronomical than they already are.
Yeah, I wonder if we might be asking for something we haven't considered all the ramifications of. Tim Versalotti?
It's an appealing idea, isn't it? If you look at the map of North Carolina from the 2000 presidential election, and you guys have a great map on your website at wunc.org, if you look at the blue and the red counties, had we apportioned the seats by congressional district, it's conceivable Gore could have picked up three in the first district in the northeastern part of the state, in the fourth district in the Durham and Orange County area, and then down in Mike McIntyre's district in the Fayetteville area. And that would empower people. It might boost turnout for either party. You could conceive of areas of upstate New York that would easily go Republican and would thus excite Republicans in a traditionally Democratic state as well. Anything that excites people, tunes them in, gets them turned out, it sounds good to me. Mm-hmm.
So, Julie, would you prefer that here in North Carolina?
You know, as you said, we haven't discussed all the ramifications, and after the last election, I kind of walked away from that whole thing being kind of anti-electoral college, and then after hearing a lot more of the conversation that's been made prior to this election, I feel better educated, and I am comfortable with the Electoral College versus a straight, you know, popular vote where, say, an entire section of the country could become so united that they would end up overpowering the rest of us. But
That's all the time we have for Julie right now. But I want to thank Tim Versalotti for being with us. Thanks so much, Tim.
You're welcome.
Tim Versalotti is professor of political science at Elon University. Just ahead, we'll be talking about spin. Brendan Nyhan, co-founder of the blog SpinSanity.org, is with us, and we welcome your calls. Have you ever been swayed by spin that you know of? 1-877-962-9862. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava. It is, of course, Election Day, and we're talking about a number of issues that have come up during this year's campaign. First, though, we go to Alan Meredith, WUNC's Alan Meredith. She is in Durham at one of the polling places. Welcome, Alan. Hi there. Let's see. Alan Meredith, hi there.
Hi. I'm standing here with Keith, who's also here with his daughter. He took the day off from work today. He has just gone in to vote. He's come out. He's voted for John Kerry. And soon he's going to be leaving here to go to the Democratic headquarters to help volunteers. He's going to volunteer to help people, to get people to the polls today. So I'll pass the phone on over to Keith.
Okay. Hi there.
Hello, Melinda.
Hi there, Keith. So I gather you were not one of those undecided voters then.
No, I'm not. Whatever the other side of voters, I ain't thinking of what but one side.
Well, tell me. So now, why was it important for you to come out today?
It's always important to come out and vote, because voting is a privilege that, as an African American, we haven't always had. So it's always a privilege to be able to do something that's freedom.
Right. Had you thought about voting early, taking advantage of the early voting that so many people have done this time around?
No, because I wanted my daughter to have the traditional experience of voting on election day, and I just did not vote in early voting because of that. I just think that she's 10 years old, and to give her the experience of the entire voting process, I think is better than the shortcut.
Yeah. So have you always taken her to the polls with you?
I've taken her or my son. He just turned 18 in September, and I called to see if he had registered for SSA. He said, not yet, but I did register to vote. So I was quite happy about that. He's in college now.
And you made sure that he voted?
I haven't talked to him yet. I was planning to call him to make sure that he's going to. But I feel pretty confident that he is, because he's always on with me.
Right, right. I heard somebody else today say that they would know how the election might go by noting whether their college-age kids had actually gotten out to vote or not, whether the college-age vote comes out.
Now, I was actually quite proud of him when he told me that he had registered to vote, so I know he's going. I feel pretty confident that he's going if he hadn't voted already.
Mm-hmm. So now, are you part of some get-out-the-vote effort today?
No, I'm just... Well, yeah, on my own get out the vote effort. I go to the Democratic headquarters, and I may go to the Durham Committee headquarters, and my phone is available. If anyone needs a ride, mm-hmm. I would take them to the polls and
all right.
do things like that.
Well, great. Well, Keith, thanks for taking time out from your get out the vote effort today to talk with us.
Okay, then. Well, thank you, and keep up the good work. And you have a great show.
Okay, thanks so much, Keith. Keith is a voter in Durham, and he's with WUNC's Alan Meredith. We will be checking in through the hour with Alan and another reporter, Cynthia Engel, who is out at a polling place, we believe, in Cary. In Wake County. But right now we are talking with Brendan Nyhan, who a few years back co-founded the website spinsanity.org. He is a student right now at Duke University, grad student there. And he and the co-founders of spinsanity.org have come out with a book called All the President's Spin, George W. Bush, the Media, and the Truth. And we welcome Brendan Nyhan back to us.
Hey, thanks to be glad to be with you.
Well, we should explain that you started Spinsanity about 3-4 years ago. And this was an effort I've read on your site to get at what you thought was manipulation of the media, of politics.
Yeah, that's right. We really felt like the media wasn't doing a good enough job of countering the spin that political candidates put out there. So we felt like it was time for someone else to look at it in a more sustained, aggressive way day after day and to keep pointing it out when the candidates keep repeating it, which is something the media doesn't often do.
Mm-hmm. And so you have a blog, spinsanity.org, and blogs have in their way become part of this year's election story, the saga of the 2004 elections.
Yeah. In fact, today on the New York Times op-ed page, the center piece was a compilation of short statements on the election by bloggers, which I thought was a sign of how far they've come in terms of being accepted by the mainstream media. And in terms of what we do, blogs have been incredibly important. This is a sort of distributed intelligence network of thousands of people who read the news, catch things, and they filter up the media food chain to the people at the top who can then get the word out to the voters.
Mm-hmm. And I went to one blog today, and as you might expect, there's already been a critique of the New York Times story about blogs, but it didn't include this blogger or that blogger or the rest. But there is a service being provided there.
I think so. You know, each individual blog, you know, it's really a matter of taste which ones you like. But the overall system, I think, is actually pretty good at fact-checking and flagging things that are out of bounds.
Mm-hmm. Now, so you've been covering spin for several years now, and I want to talk about this presidential election. Were there particular orbits that the spin went into this time that that struck you, that may have even taken your breath away? Or have you become jaded to this now?
You know, after a while, I think they have less an impact maybe on me than they did, but I have been struck. One thing is I would be surprised to see senators running for president, given what's happened to John Kerry in this campaign. Having a voting record that can be picked apart and taken out of context has proven to be an incredible handicap. One of the things that Bush has done most effectively is take individual votes from Kerry's Senate career and portray them in misleading ways. And that's something he's hammered the entire campaign. So we have statistics that are mostly phony about how many times Kerry voted to raise gas taxes, voted to raise income taxes, and on down the line. And Kerry has spent so much time defending his votes that he hasn't had nearly as much time to talk about what he wants to do.
Mm-hmm. Because there had been a wisdom among Politico types that, yeah, senators don't usually make very good presidential candidates. And is it just this time around we just saw greater evidence of that because of that, because you had that scorecard that people could point to?
Yeah, you get caught. Not only does the Senate not train you to talk like a normal person, which is, I think, a problem that a lot of senators have faced, but you have this paper trail that governors don't, and that really is a handicap. And on Kerry's side, I was struck by this attack on Social Security that he's opened up in the last month.
Attack by John Kerry of George Bush.
Yes, he says George Bush has a plan to cut your Social Security benefits by 30% to 45%. Now, actually, what George Bush, he hasn't endorsed a specific plan, and this statistic of 30% to 45% comes from people born after 2000. The cut they would get in their benefits in 50 or 60 years, according to one plan that Bush's commission recommended. But Bush hasn't proposed this, and it's certainly not going to happen to any seniors who are getting Social Security today. But I think that's been an effective attack and one that Kerry is pushing really hard to get, you know, more senior votes.
And it's one that Democrats have used before. I mean, yeah. This is not the first time a Democratic candidate has used this against a Republican candidate.
And that's what's almost amazing about it is it's such a sort of hoary cliche, the Democrats running around saying they're going to take away your Social Security. But that's exactly what he's doing.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Brendan Nyhan, who is one of the co-founders of the website, the blog, spinsanity.org, also co-author of All the President's Spin. If you want to join our conversation, the number is 1-877-962-9862, 1-877-962-9862. So in this race, in your view, who's stretching the truth the most?
That is a good question. We try not to make these overall summary judgments about who's stretching the truth more. They've both done it a lot, and it's hard to add up exactly what ends up being more or less. I would say that Bush has been more repetitive in his use of a few particular misleading charges. So saying Kerry's the most liberal member of the Senate, using these statistics about tax raises, and he hammers those again and again and again in a way that Kerry hasn't. So I think he's been more effective at it. Kerry has been more, you know, one day he's saying this and the other day he's saying that. So he's thrown out a lot of misleading charges. What he hasn't done is hammer them repeatedly the way Bush has.
Mm-hmm. So why is there a reluctance to use the word about your opponent that he lied?
That's a great question. You know, and we don't use that word actually if in the book, which a lot of people were surprised about. And the reason is we just don't know what people intend to do when they say something. Do they intend? You know, one of the definitions of lying is intention to mislead.
And, is this about like absence of malice here? Is that what we're?
Well, and it's just you can't mind read what someone's trying to do. So what we say is the effect of this statement, regardless of what they meant to say, is misleading. And when they say it in a way that's misleading over and over and over, we can conclude that they're probably trying to deceive you. But whether it's a lie or not, you get into the semantic discussion that ultimately strikes us as not very useful.
I think on page 2 of your book, All the President's Spin, you write, each of the statements is true. You're talking about the president here, and you had given some examples of things he had said. Each of the statements is true, but Bush's words were carefully constructed to leave a false impression.
Right, exactly. And then that's one of the key tactics, I think, that we've seen in this campaign more than any other. The press is really good at hammering you on things that are absolutely false. That is something the media does well. What they don't do well are hit people on things that are half true but misleading. And that has been a tactic that both sides have used over and over and over. And it's very hard for reporters to say, well, this part of it is true, but this part isn't. And here's how you get a misleading impression. In the context of a short news story, that's just very difficult to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You are listening to The State of Things. We're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. Brendan Nyhan is with us for the rest of the hour. He is co-author of All the President's Spin. Right now, though, we want to take a look at the military vote, because for the first time in decades, we're choosing a president when our country is at war. And North Carolina is, of course, home to many military personnel and their families. We have two of the three largest military installations in the country in North Carolina. And with us right now to talk about the military vote is Peter Fever, who's a professor of political science at Duke and director of the Triangle Institute for Security Studies. Welcome, Peter Fever.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us today. Now, what does the polling tell us about the military vote? Who are they favoring in the presidential race?
Well, unlike with the general population, where you can't swing a dead cat without hitting a poll, there's very little systematic data about the military. And this is partly for a good reason. The military are very difficult to reach by normal polls. They're not really caught up in large enough numbers in a general Gallup poll, for instance. So they're not caught in the normal way. And it turns out it's against the law to survey them directly on political matters, although that law has never been tested, so I suspect it would be struck down if ever challenged. But you put all of this together, you don't have a lot of systematic data, and that's why there were literally scores of articles by reporters, particularly through the summer, suggesting that maybe the military would tilt towards Senator Kerry. Senator Kerry made extraordinary efforts to woo the military, and especially in his convention, reached out to the military, made it look like a Republican convention, some people said, with all of the military trappings.
His reporting for duty is,
yes,
was his line as he came into his speech.
Precisely, and the salute, all of, you know, the atmospherics. And so there was some expectation, and many people, including myself, thought that he might make some, might have an appeal to the military. There were two surveys, though, done in September and October, very different designs, and one of them sort of has some problematic features in it that would tilt it, some of the features tilted towards Bush, some of it tilted towards Kerry. But in any case, two different surveys that show pretty convincingly that the military has a very strong affect for Bush and a quite strong negative affect towards Kerry.
What is the issue with Kerry? Is it because after Vietnam he spoke out against the war and was so so upfront about that?
It's probably several features. One of them is his Vietnam War protest. Not obviously he served nobly in Vietnam and quite bravely, but then he came home and he protested the war, but also spoke out about alleged war crimes and invoked a lot of testimony that was subsequently debunked, but that seemed that the military took as an attack on his troops or his, you know, fellow comrades. And there's many veterans and many military people who are still upset about that. But it's also, I think, has more to do with doubts about whether he would be a good commander-in-chief. If you look at the internal questions in the poll, not just the top line, do you approve or who would you vote for, but look at the internal questions about who would be a better leader, who would be a better commander-in-chief, who has a better plan for Iraq, all of those kinds of questions, Kerry scores very, very lowly. And I think the military just generally have doubts that he would be a good commander-in-chief, and they're saying it's wartime, it's a dangerous time to have in charge someone who would not be, in their judgment, a good commander-in-chief.
I wonder, do these polls separate out those people who were soldiers, you know, based at Fort Bragg, and those who were members of the National Guard and reservists who had left their everyday lives behind because they were called up? I wonder if there are different views among those and their families.
Right. Well, both surveys had distinguished between active duty versus reserve and guard. They didn't zero it in onto Fort Bragg, but there was no difference between the active duty and the guard and reserve in the two survey samples. So no meaningful difference on these kinds of questions. There was a difference among the families of guardsmen. They were the least enthusiastic about Bush. Their enthusiasm for Bush was just maybe 5-10 points higher than the general public, whereas it was significantly higher in the other subgroups. So the families of the reserves and guard, those who have arguably shouldered some of the toughest load in terms of the Iraq war burden, they did show less enthusiasm for Bush, but nevertheless a majority favoring Bush and on in these internal questions.
Mm-hmm. And in that case, that sample would be across the country because those families are all across the
right.
country, not just concentrated here in
right.
North Carolina.
That second one was, I'm referencing as an Annenberg poll, which was done sort of nationwide, but it's a small sample. And so if you press it too far and you try to distinguish between families in one region or the other, you're probably pressing beyond what the poll can sustain.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Peter Fever, I want to thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Peter Fever is a political science professor at Duke University and director of the Triangle Institute for Security Studies. 1-877-962-9862 is our number. Brendan Nyhan is with us and talking about spin in this campaign. If you want to join the conversation, again, the number is 1-877-962-9862. And let's go right now to Cynthia Engel, who is in Kerry. Hi there, Cynthia Engel.
Melinda.
Now, you're at a polling place in Kerry.
I am at the Kerry Academy. It very quiet here.
Really?
Yeah, there was a line when the polls here at the Cary Academy opened this morning, but right now the voters are just trickling in. But I do have a voter who just cast her ballot, Tamala, and she says she thinks the ballots are very clear and doesn't understand why people are talking about disenfranchised voters. I'm going to hand the phone over to her.
Sure. Hi there, Tamala. Hi, Tamala.
Yes.
Hi, this is Melinda Pencava. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Oh, good. So you voted today.
I did.
And this is not the first time you voted?
No.
Okay.
Definitely not.
Uh-huh. So, and didn't find any problems with it?
Not at all.
Oh.
I think it's very clear system. It's concise. There are people there who are helpful. And people here in our state, I do think we should change this, too. We don't have any form of ID required when we vote,
mm-hmm.
and I believe that we should do that. And that should be changed, but that has to be changed through the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
So people can come in without an ID, too. So it's really an easy process.
Right, so you were not asked for ID when you went to the polls?
No.
Now, is this the kind of a burning issue that you would contact your legislator about when the dust is cleared after this?
I would, actually.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of case would you make for it?
Well, I do think that an ID, a simple ID, people have to carry IDs with them for most things that they need in life, and to not have an ID and use that as an excuse to say that people, we don't want to keep anyone away because it would discourage them if they don't have an ID, I don't think that's a valid reason.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think it's a good way to avoid voter fraud as well.
Well, Tamala, I want to thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Tamala is a voter who is voting at the Cary Academy, and she was with reporter Cynthia Engel. 1-877-962-9862 is the number. Brendan Nyhan is with us. This has become an issue before the race, Brendan, before the elections today, of this question about whether people are being disenfranchised or whether there could be fraud at the polls. And I'd like to hear your take on the spin that might go into this, but we have to take a quick break right now. We'll get back to Brendan Nyhan, and we'll be talking with you at 1-877-962-9862. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. It is, as you know, Election Day in North Carolina and across the country. With us is Brendan Nyhan, co-founder of the blog SpinSanity.org and co-author of the book All the President's Spin. We're taking your calls about spin and other subjects at 1-877-962-9862. Well, Brendan, just before the break, we heard from a voter who was in Cary who was saying that she had no problem at the polls, but she was raising the question of why there was no ID required. And this has been a big issue between Republicans and Democrats, one side accusing the other of potential fraud at the polls because no ID is required. The other side, Democrats are saying Republicans may be trying to intimidate voters. And I'm wondering if you've cut through the spin on this.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I can give you a good answer, unfortunately. You know, it's all about how we strike this balance between protecting against voter fraud on the one hand and preventing people from voting on the other. And that's a very difficult balance to strike. The thing that's really hard about the debate right now is we're essentially in the fog of war period. We don't know what's actually going on out there. And all we hear are these very scattered anecdotal reports, and both sides connect the dots in their head and say it's a massive scheme by the other side. And we just don't know if those are actually just isolated incidents or not. A lot of these incidents that people are touting, if you go and investigate them, as some newspapers have, it turns out there's nothing there. But if you string enough of them together on TV, it sounds like there's a massive scheme to steal the election. And unfortunately, if you do that enough, everyone thinks you know, the system is rigged against them, and it really hurts the legitimacy of the electoral process.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Judy is in Durham and I think has a question along these lines. Hi there, Judy.
Hi. I was just a little surprised by the previous caller because I just came away from the polls in Johnston County. I live in Clayton, and we were asked for our ID, and everybody that I saw online had to present some sort of ID to be able to verify their identity to vote.
If I heard correctly, I think the HVA, the Help America Vote Act, said that if you had registered to vote after, I believe it was a year and a half ago or so, and had not presented a photo ID at the time of registering to vote, that when you went to vote, to exercise your right to vote, you had to show who you are.
It may vary by by county or even by precinct, because when I went to vote in Durham this morning, I just registered at my new address within the last couple of months, and I was not asked for an ID. And she even asked me for my address to confirm who I was, but of course it was on the sticker right in front of me, so it's not like I couldn't have just read it off the page right there. So it doesn't appear to be very uniform.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of being asked for your ID, Judy?
It didn't offend me at all. I would hope that they would ask for some sort of ID from everyone. They asked us to present our driver's license, or some people I knew had student IDs or senior citizen IDs, and I thought that was very appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Of course, there is always the possibility of somebody presenting a false ID, too.
Well, that's true. And if they're that hot to vote, well, it would take, I would think, an extremely concerted effort to throw an election with a bunch of false IDs.
Right.
But
usually that's done to get beer when you're underage rather than get into the ballot box.
No, I don't even think I remember those days. I have to admit. But
it's nice being carded, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. Well, Judy, thank you for your call.
Well, thank you.
Okay,
bye-bye.
1-877-962-9862 is our number. And Tim is in Raleigh. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I had a quick question that I know there's always been a little bit of concern with the fact that when some of the polls close because of the time differences, there are other polls that are open, and that could impact voting. And I was wondering if with the early voting in some states, if those numbers are available quicker, could that provide more of an opportunity for a spin or for somebody to say, oh, well, look, you know, our guy's winning and, maybe I won't go vote because it really won't matter now.
That's a great point. Slate is one of the websites that's now leaking exit poll results on the web early. So the combination of those coming out around 3 o'clock this afternoon and these early polling, these early voting results becoming available, it's not really clear what that could do, because it could also demobilize some people who are disappointed in how their candidate's doing, but it could also cause a surge as they say, wow, we're really behind. We need to get out there and vote. So it's actually not clear what the result would be. Given how fast information circulates now, I wouldn't be surprised if that actually did have an effect.
And practically speaking, I believe the swing states, because according to the polls, they have the rest of the country carved up as red or blue states for the president or for John Kerry. But the swing states tend to be in Central Time Zone and East, right?
Yeah, largely, with a couple of exceptions.
Ohio. But then there's always Hawaii.
That's right.
Could you imagine if it came down to that?
We could be
We're
up till 4 in the morning.
Hours.
Yeah, absolutely. If it's within a few electoral votes, we will all be sitting there till 4 in the morning.
Right. Tim, do you have any ideas on how that should be done?
No, because I've always felt that it was a little bit odd that, you know, those numbers were available. And I would think that it would have some kind of a psychological impact one way or the other. And I've always thought, well, you know, maybe they should just have a time that's universally, you know, accepted. We'll count them now.
Mm-hmm. There is that problem with Hawaii, though. But go on.
Yeah, I had a quick comment about the military thing, if you got time.
Yeah.
I spent 20 years in the military, and I was kind of curious if anybody has thought about the potential of the psychological factor of a military person who is, you know, pretty much bred to follow the orders of the officers in charge. And so they, it creates that environment. And then you have this president who visits them and is cheering them on. He's the commander in chief. He's the guy we're following. You know, is there a potential there for the psychology of the military person to say, you know, that's the commander in chief. I'm going to vote for him.
This has actually been a question. The Pentagon has been pushing very hard for soldiers to vote who are abroad. And people can view that in two different ways. One is these are people who are fighting for our country and they deserve to vote. And I think everyone agrees on that. But some people do see it as political because they've been pushing so hard to get all those votes in there. Some of these military ballots that came in late were actually some of the deciding votes in Florida. So the administration certainly has a strong awareness of how important military ballots could be. And those, you know, in swing states, they really could make the difference.
Mm-hmm. But of course, as Peter Fever was talking just a moment ago, there was a somewhat of a disparity between the rest of the military vote and the families of those who were say, in National Guard and reservists who were called up. While there was support among all those groups for the president, it was somewhat less in those groups. 1-877-962-9862 is our number. And joining us once again is WUNC's Alan Meredith, who is once again in Durham, and this time she's at the polls with yet another voter. Hi there, Alan.
Hi, Melinda. I'm here with Gay Beth, and she moved to Durham from Texas in 1997, and she's here with her son, John. So I'm going to pass the phone over to Gay Beth.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Hi, Melinda.
Hi, Gay Beth. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having us on.
Thanks for talking with us today. So so you moved to North Carolina from Texas. May I ask which way you voted in the presidential race?
We voted for George Bush.
Mm-hmm. Now, he had been your governor when you were in Texas.
That's correct, yes. And we were very pleased with him in Texas. What we had watched him campaign for, we saw him bring to fruition in the office once he was elected. And he didn't dawdle. He was quick about it, and he fulfilled his campaign promises. They certainly were not empty.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe he will do that again.
Right. Well, I'd love to talk to you. What was it like to vote today?
It was very smooth. Actually, here in Durham County, we had no waiting, and we were able to get right in and right out again.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody there was very polite and no problems.
Right. Well, I think you might be the second person we talked to in Durham today who brought their child to the polls. Is that something you always do?
No, actually, my son John is here with me. He moved here to North Carolina in June this year, and we registered him at the Center Festival, which was, in August, I believe. And they sent his voter registration card, and we were able to get in and out with no problem.
Okay, so he was a participant, not just a spectator there.
Right, right.
Okay, all right. Well, Gay Beth, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Melinda.
Okay. Thanks so much to WUNC's Alan Meredith, who's been in Durham this hour talking to voters there. 1-877-962-9862. Brendan Nyhan from SpinSanity.org is with us. In your view, what was the most egregious spin that you heard this campaign season?
Ooh, that is a good question.
The most jaw-dropping spin, let's put it that way.
You know, I'm not sure I can give you a single answer. I would point to some of these tax statistics as being the most outrageous in the sense that they're so easily checked. And the way that they've been repeated over and over. Actually, you know what? I'm going to amend that. The global test. I'm going to take that back. The global test, I think was worse, because it was at a presidential debate, which everybody saw and everybody heard exactly what John Kerry said. And he said, "I won't give any country a veto over our security, but any preemptive action we take has to pass a global test in terms of being able to explain why we did what we did." I think it was a pretty clear statement. And George Bush has gone around for the past month saying John Kerry is talking about a global test that would give control of our security to the UN. And everyone saw John Kerry say exactly the opposite, and he's just done it. And even though he's been criticized, he's done it over and over. And in fact, a lot of news reports have portrayed it as like a matter of opinion, like, well, maybe John Kerry's giving the UN a veto and maybe he's not. And I think it was very clear from the statement. And, you know, I would point to that one as the worst.
Could it be that John Kerry sometimes does not speak in blunt, quick, snappy statements, and so therefore they are so much more open to interpretation, and lets George Bush, Karl Rove, have a field day?
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely a problem, and it's hurt him because his words are ambiguous. George Bush, it's so underappreciated what a good politician he is. For all you can say about his verbal style, he is very clear. He uses very short declarative sentences, and people know exactly what he means. And John Kerry can't do that, and he's paid a price.
So why doesn't John Kerry's campaign, have they not been as effective? If there's clarity in what the president says, that doesn't necessarily mean that you can't puncture it. Why has Kerry's camp just not been as effective at spinning it out?
They never settled on a negative critique of Bush. I think this is one of the things people have really been struck by. Bush had two critiques of John Kerry. He set them up in March. One is he's a flip-flopper. Two is he's too liberal. And they repeated those over and over for 8 months. And everyone can repeat each of them verbatim because we've all heard them so many times. With Kerry, he's offered up so many different critiques that you know, he never lined everybody up behind one. One of the jobs of a presidential candidate is to set the agenda rhetorically for all the people down the ticket, all the surrogates. And because the critique changed every day, I think a lot of people were very frustrated that one specific critique of Bush never became the focus. I think that was probably their biggest strategic mistake.
Okay. We go now to Jim, who's calling from near Columbia. Hi there, Jim.
Hi. How are you all today? Enjoying the program. I was in Fayetteville near Fort Bragg in the 60s, late 60s, during the era of Vietnam, and I was a dissident and was struck by the number of military people who were dissident if they had a chance. And I'm wondering, with the advent of blogging, if that doesn't provide a perhaps a safer venue for persons who question the rightness of military action who happen to be in the military at the time. Is what's the extent of blogging among enlisted personnel?
That is a great question. In fact, there are a number of blogs by people serving in Iraq, both with their name attached and anonymously. And I think one of the reasons is people are worried about the political repercussions of criticizing the president while they're serving over there. So that has created an avenue for expressing dissent if you're an active duty soldier. And, you know, another thing that's relevant along these lines is Michael Moore has a new book out that's a compilation of emails sent to him by troops that agree with him, that agree with his perspective on Bush. And as Peter Fever was pointing out, those people, I think, are hardly representative of the total population of the military. But, you know, Moore claims to have gotten about 3,000 of these, and there are probably several hundred in this book he's put out.
Are we able to put figures at what the support for the president is versus Kerry among the military?
I would defer to Peter on that. I don't know the exact numbers, but I believe the numbers are pretty disproportionate. You know, compared to Vietnam when we had a draft, the military was more representative of society as a whole. The all-volunteer army has skewed much more Southern Republican and Christian than the overall population.
Okay. We go to Sarah, who is in Fayetteville. Hi there, Sarah.
Hi. How are you? I enjoy your show. Thanks.
Oh, thanks for calling.
I am in the military, and one of the concerns I have this year with the election being so close is possibly military votes from overseas, as well as from families that aren't necessarily registered in the state that they live in. Maybe their votes because I've talked to several people overseas whose ballots were not to them in time, and I know that was a concern in 2000 as well, that several absentee ballots from military personnel were not counted, and as about 75% is generally what I've understood the military support for Republicans to be. That could make a difference this year. And I'm just wondering if anyone else has addressed that concern throughout the state. A question for your guest speaker.
Well, that is a great question. I'm sorry I didn't think of it sooner because it seems like we might have dedicated an entire show to this issue. But perhaps, you know, if things get tight in the vote counting, that became an issue in Florida in 2000. Were those ballots, if they had not been postmarked by Election Day, wherever in the world they were, did they count?
Right. Brenda? Yeah. And I think the Pentagon has tried to publicize the deadlines much earlier this time to avoid that problem. They also had some sort of a program where you could vote electronically. I think you could even email in a scanned version of your ballot in some cases. People were worried about the security of that, but it would allow people to get their votes in much later. So I think there are more opportunities to get those votes counted, but we won't know for sure until probably later this week.
Mm-hmm. So Brendan Nyhan, you do the Spin Sanity blog. You're co-author of this book, All the President's Spin, and you worked on a couple of campaigns before you started the blog. So what are you doing on election night?
Well, I'm going to one or two election night parties to watch the results.
Really?
Yeah, and I'm not sure exactly how long I will last because I'm such an information junkie. I think I'm gonna have to go home and get online and try to figure out what's going on because I get too frustrated watching one TV channel. But
even if you set up a bunch of TV screens, it wouldn't be enough.
That's what I need. I need the Karl Rove with the seven TVs, but unfortunately, I can't afford it.
Well, okay. Well, maybe we'll see what you do with this book. Maybe you could after that. But thank you for being with us so much.
It was my pleasure.
Brendan Nyhan is co-author of All the President's Spin. Thanks to our other guests, Tim Versalotti and Peter Fever, and to Alan Meredith and Cynthia Engel for their reports from polling places. Thank you, too, for listening. If you have a comment about a program, you can drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. Don't forget to check out our website, wunc.org. We have historic voting maps of the state. Yep, we've divided them into red and blue counties, and they're all there at wunc.org. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC.